The next matter on the calendar is Reitz versus City of St. Paul. As counsel are getting situated, I'll welcome you to the Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. With me today are Judges Smith and Klapacki. You can be seated whenever you're ready. Each party will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. When you begin your comments, give us your name and the party you represent so that we have that for the recording for future reference. The podium is adjustable, so you can adjust that with a little toggle switch if you would like to suit your comfort. Whenever appellant's counsel is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Renz, R-E-N-Z, and Gary Luloff on behalf of the relator, Officer Eric Reitz. Your Honors, we're asking that this court reverse the City of St. Paul's decision denying Officer Reitz indemnification for a lawsuit that was initiated against him.
Minnesota Statute 466.07 says municipality must defend and indemnify, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the standard here is what?
There are two standards operating. One is that the statute is mandatory, that the City of St. Paul must indemnify. There are two qualifiers for that statute. The only one that we understand to be at issue based on the briefing is whether or not Officer Reitz is considered as acting in performance of the duties of the position.
You know, in insurance law, a duty to defend may be different than a duty to indemnify. And it doesn't take much to get a duty to defend. Is any of that law applicable to this statute?
I think it is, Your Honor, not directly. As you rightly note, it's a separate area of law. However, the idea that the duty to indemnify and defend is almost uniformly, especially in the insurance law cases, broader than, or the duty to defend is often broader than the duty to indemnify. In other words, those who have those duties to defend and or indemnify, but particularly to defend, that duty is broader than whether or not they are actually liable. And so I think as related—
I think sometimes we've said, you know, if there's any question, any possibility,
right,
then there's a duty to at least defend. Indemnify may be another question. Does that principle apply here, do you think?
I believe that principle should apply. I believe that when the legislature creates a statute like this that provides for that defense and indemnification, that they are undertaking a very similar responsibility, and therefore those same concepts, even though they come out of another branch of law.
So you don't think that concept in the insurance law I think that principle arises out of most of these contracts for insurance. I don't know whether the statute and the contracts for insurance have the same principles. You're thinking they do.
I do. I think that the contracts are so different as between one insurer to the other that actually what's developed is a general principle that the duty to defend is broad, and it would apply here.
Is there any, at present, legal authority that there's a different standard for defense versus indemnification under the statute?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you. And then if you're saying there is a different standard, what is the standard that applies for defense as opposed to indemnification in this context?
In this context, I would just borrow from the insurance context, which is to say, if there's any question as to whether or not there should be any coverage under the statute, certainly for purposes of defense, it would lean in favor of providing the defense, and then the indemnification could be determined, neither of which were provided here at Officer Reitz.
So the standard wouldn't be whether the act was in performance of duties, but whether for defense, whether there is any question that the officer was acting in performance of official duties, and that's a different standard for indemnification.
I agree, and I think...
I'm asking that, yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Sorry, I would say that that is true. And in this case, I think ultimately we get to acting in performance of the duties because now that that other case is resolved, though what we're seeking really is the cost of defense. And so a broader application is what should be applicable. There are three primary reasons that we believe officer...
Can you rewind that a second? You're asking indemnification doesn't matter?
No, indemnification...
I mean, for...
Defense is what really matters here. There is not an indemnification claim to the city. It is solely one of defense and having covered those costs, which were denied, and Officer Reitz was required to cover those costs himself.
Now, you know, we sometimes were referred to legislative history if there's some ambiguity. Do we know, I don't know whether we're claiming an ambiguity here, but is there any legislative history that suggests that the state wanted to protect officers at least for providing a defense?
I have no specific legislative history to cite to you. I can imagine no other reason there's a statute that exists like this. Going back to the three primary reasons why we're seeking coverage, one, Officer Reitz was acting in performance of his duties as a police officer at the time of the alleged omission. Second, the city itself cloaked Officer Reitz.
Well, if you're applying the insurance standard, it would only be arguably was...
Arguably, but even so,
insurance standard,
I think we're covered either way because I think he was in the performance of his duties.
Okay.
Secondly, the city cloaked him with the emblems of city authority. And thirdly, as you look at the cases, and there's been a rash of cases cited by both counsel in the course of briefing, but when you look at those collectively, with multiple emblems of official authority, an absence of personal animus or desire as the motivation, and it occurring in the jurisdiction in which the officer is a police officer, this comes a lot closer to resembling the cases where there was a sufficient connection between the conduct and the duties to provide an official presence. So
this absence of personal animus, what you're saying is it's unlike the cases where it's a domestic violence situation involving an officer and his or her...
Exactly.
Another, or a neighborhood dispute. He's out there in a uniform doing what police sort of do, keep order.
Precisely. Precisely. The cases, I'll just start with those cases, where there's been found that there's insufficient connection. Examples are you don't have a uniform or a squad or a badge or a gun. Roe versus Humke, that's the officer who molested a girl at his farm. Second, McGee is like that, which is the police union writing editorial. Lawrence is like that. His ex-girlfriend shows up. In that case, they didn't have any of these emblems.
And McGee seems a lot, it seems not at all like this case.
I completely agree.
There's no uniform involved. It's a union activity. It's letters to the editor. It's free speech. I mean, that doesn't seem like that's this case.
I agree. And so also that's true for Lawrence and also for Rao. All those cases, those are things that were either out of their jurisdiction, they didn't have all these emblems of authority, or they're acting out of this personal animus or this lustful desire. You contrast that with things like Carter, where we've got officers in uniform with a badge and a gun. They're in the jurisdiction in which they're police officers, and they're not performing acts out of personal desires or animus. They're related to crowd control or security in keeping people secure in their person from lawless other individuals or arrest. Looking at the Carter decision, the Yazizu decision, the Mahaffey decision, those cases are a lot closer to this case. In this case, Officer Reitz is in uniform. He's got his badge. He's got his gun. He's got his squad car. The squad car and the uniform, you can't even show up to off-duty without the city blessing it.
So here's what, go ahead. So we have those, as you talk, the emblems of city authority. Let's say, and I'm trying to put this on where, I'm assuming even, that's not, is that sufficient? So for example, I'll give an example. You're hired as a security officer, you have your squad outside, you're in your uniform, you spill your Coke You just leave it there, someone comes in and slips and falls. Is there a defense and indemnification because that person, and it was the allegation is negligent to drop your coat on the floor and not to clean it up and so on. Is there, is a city obligated to defend and indemnify because the person was in uniform?
I think if that which they were doing at the time they spilled the Coke was related to the types of things that are official conduct, as we look at those, protecting crowds and the public, providing security in person, maintaining health and safety, if they are doing those things at the time of they accidentally spilled Coke.
So if you're sitting at the security table.
Right.
And you spill your Coke.
Yes.
And someone, no one's there, you're not exercising, any, you're, I mean, no one's coming in or anything, you're just sitting there, you spill your Coke, and then an employee walks by and slips and falls, and you get sued. I don't know, I'm trying to figure out something. Is it just the fact, then, that the rule that you would have is, us say, is that if you're in your uniform and so on, and you're hired to be a security, to perform security for a private entity, any negligence while you're on the job of security is if there's negligence alleged that you are owed as a police officer defense and indemnification by the city.
I think if the negligence occurred as part of doing some of those police functions.
Well, I mean, yes. Spilling your Coke isn't a police function, but it's during while you're on the job as security.
Right. Then
I mean, is that your rule?
I think that that could possibly be, but I don't even think we're looking for a rule as broad as the one that you're assembling there. We're really just, we want to focus on this case, and there's two combination of two things going on. One, all these emblems of official authority, and we aren't saying if you've got a uniform on, the city's got to cover you. But when the city says, we okay you to go there.
So that's a control issue.
It is a control issue, Your Honor. They said you have to go through your scheduler. They have to alert us that you're there. We'll give you permission to do it. Specific permission to use your uniform, specific permission to pull up a city vehicle, a squad car marked with all the emblems of authority. And then
right,
when
but
you're
that,
there,
but
you
that
are,
might not be enough.
Right.
And so then let's get to what makes it enough. That's my interest. And
thank you, Your
Honor. And what you're saying is performing security by screening, presumably.
Right.
Okay.
And I would point to a few cases. One, in Carter, they talk about the responsibility to protect crowds and the public. In Yazizu, they talk about a duty to provide citizens security and persons from lawless people. In the Ivy decision, they talk about maintaining health and safety of the surrounding people. Those are all part of the, are related to the function, the very function that Officer Reitz is serving at the Dorothy Day Center, which serves significant amounts of the city's own homeless population. They are only there 2 hours a week, or 2 hours a night, excuse me. They're there when everybody's filing in. And if you look at the reason that they're there, and that comes from the complaint, the under, complaint and the underlying matter, and it's much like they talk about in the testimony in the Ivy case, it's because it matters when you show up as an officer. That's
so
a lot different
than... So is
sort
of the police can't have it both ways? I mean, they, if they want to allow their officers out there and somebody else is paying the freight for the time, the city's got an advantage. Somebody else is paying these officers instead of the city having to pay the officers to do what is ultimately a city policing function. Is that the...
That's exactly... I wholeheartedly concur with that.
And is that true regarding... You're talking about Dorothy Day, but I assume then your argument would be the same if you're working for whatever private company doing security, if you're working at Excel, if you're in-house at a, you know, a financial institution doing security.
I think it gets weaker the farther you get away from, one, the city of St. Paul itself, where he's an officer, two, public places. The Dorothy Day Center is a private entity, but clearly that's the public homeless population that's coming in. Or the Excel Center, another great example, a lot of public. If you're at the Opperman Mansion, outside of the jurisdiction, and
let's say inside the jurisdiction.
Okay, inside the jurisdiction. And it's not the general public, for example. There are other people that are coming in. I think that becomes more attenuated. That's not what's at issue here. Or if you're doing things there that aren't related to security. If you're doing balloon animals or lifeguarding the pool, those don't have to do with what you do as a police officer, but here...
Right, I'm sticking in the security world,
okay.
And I'm trying...
Yep.
It sounds like you do see that there could be some distinction depending on for whom you're providing security or what the event is around which you're providing security.
If you were providing security but you didn't have your squad car, I think there's all sorts of pieces that... that add along the line of the continuum where you're kind of pulling out to see where that line is. But wherever that line is, REITs is way inside of it. And the reason he's way inside of it is the city is already okayed all of this. All of the things that are the city, the badge, the uniform, the squad, he had to tell them he's going to be there. He's scheduled to be there. He's dealing with City of St. Paul's population.
Right. Well, that would be true for the other private places where someone would be.
Sure.
Right. I mean, that's the general policy that applies to all.
Right. But
At the point of the screening, which is the admission that the negligence is based on.
Yes.
Was there any at that point, I mean, one way I was thinking about it in context of other cases and trying to see if this is true, is at the point, is to think whether if there was an officer who was just happened to be around, like in the hospital or at, you know, outside the Walgreens, you know, the other cases that you have, and the business owner, the proprietor or whatever, sought the assistance of the police officer, like to remove someone or to do, you know, and that police officer would then have some law, some authority to act. You know, they could actually, at the request of a property owner or someone, like remove a person who's being disruptive or disturbing the peace, et cetera. But what I'm wondering is, so I was trying to think, well, is that one way we can look at it? Would an officer walking by have some authority to act here, such that it would be a performance of duties? And I'm thinking, and I'm looking at the moment of negligence that's alleged here, it's failure to find a, oh, I'm sorry, I'm way over.
Go ahead.
Okay, a weapon that by policy but not by law is prohibited from being brought in. Could an officer walking by have arrested or searched, more importantly, searched the person coming into the Dorothy Day? Is there some legal authority to search at that moment?
Well, I think if they want admission to a private facility and the private person is requiring that they be searched as a part of going in, then yes, they can be subject to search.
And a police officer just...
They could ask the officer to do it, and if the person has the option to either consent to the search or walk, and if they violated and went in anyway, then it's clearly a trespass, if not some other crime. So I think yes, in that circumstance. I see my time's up.
No.
And I'm sorry, I should have asked for permission to answer. Thank you.
I hope that's the worst thing that happens today. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kyle Sitta, C-I-T-T-A, and I'm here on behalf of the City of St. Paul in this matter. So as you know, the statute at issue in this case says that the city shall defend and indemnify one of its officers so long as that officer is acting in the performance of the duties of the position of a police officer, right? So I think there's a lot to unpack there, and what I'm going to try and do today is try and unpack that for us.
I have a question about that, and I don't know what the status of these people are out on West 7th Street, just a few blocks from here when I go to the Wild game, but there are police officers and cars, and they have their lights on, and some of them are near the door, and some of them are out in the intersection. They all look like police officers to me, and if they tell me to stop, I figure I'm being told to stop by a police officer.
That is a very good observation, Your Honor. And in fact, I think you've hit on a key point in this case. They are telling you to stop. They are performing a law enforcement duty under the law.
Sometimes they tell me to stop even when the light is green and the walk sign is on, though.
That is a law enforcement duty, Your Honor. They are performing a law enforcement duty at that moment in time. And I agree. If I am going to be honest with you, if I'm Mr. Reitz's attorney, I'm going to hammer the fact that Mr. Reitz looks like a cop. In fact, if I told my wife what this case is about, she'd be like, Kyle, are you kidding me? He looks like a police officer. How is he not a police officer? He's not a police officer because the law tells me he's not a police officer. He's not a police officer until he acts in the performance of the duty of an officer. And so what I explain in the brief is there's sort of like three ingredients that you kind of need here, right? You need the actual authority to act. That means you have to be the officer, right? You can't just detain someone if you're not an officer.
Yeah, I can't use the cop car.
Right. I hope not, Your Honor, at least. Let me know if you
I hope not, too.
I'll have my boss talk to you. You need that apparent authority too. Well, I shouldn't say you need it. It helps to be able to have that emblem and tell the rest of the world, I can wield that actual authority, helps, but it's not dispositive, as in the Kroll case. But here's the point. You need action. You need performance. You need to, quite literally in the text of this statute, act in the performance of that actual and apparent authority.
So if the officer here, instead of not finding the weapon, had found the weapon, and there were a claim that somehow that harmed somebody or was a violation of someone's constitutional rights, or maybe in removing it he cut somebody, I don't know. Think up a reason. But if he had found it, would you agree?
So I think that's a great question. I keep saying that. I don't mean to pander. That is a good question.
Well, I think they're good questions.
You are the Court of Appeals. That is a different case. So let's say Mr. Reitz finds the knife, or somebody finds the knife in the screening, and the Catholic Charities, as a private business, says, we don't allow knives in this building. Please either bin it or you can leave. And the man says, make me. And so then Catholic Charities turns to Mr. Reitz and says, make him, eject him. And Mr. Reitz says, you're out of here, buddy, and ejects him. That's State v. Ivey, because in this court, in State v. Ivey, said that that dual capacity public-private trigger occurs when that officer had probable cause to eject the person and for violating two laws.
The Ivey panel, doesn't that have to do with the reason that was the trigger was that was the charge? The charge had to do with interfering with the police officer doing the duties.
I believe there were two crimes that were committed in Ivey. One is disturbing the peace, and the other was criminal trespass. So if Mr. Reitz had found the knife and the man is asked to leave and refuses, it's State v. Ivey all over again. That's you are committing the criminal trespass, and if he's making a ruckus about it, you've got a disturbing the peace charge. And this court in Ivey made that holding narrow, and it said that trigger occurred when that officer had the probable cause to arrest for these crimes. Where's the crime?
So in other words, your answer to my question is it would be, if he had found a knife and something happens, we very well might have, under your view of things, we very well might have indemnity.
Exactly.
Since we didn't find it, we don't have indemnity.
It's possible. And even if he found the knife, I think it's just a different factual situation.
The danger, though, in using the Ivey principle, which was based upon a different set of facts where there were crimes, and then saying automatically now you only have indemnity when there is a crime, is what you just said. It seems to me that you can be performing duties without there being a crime.
So I don't actually think, let me be clear, I don't think my principle is that there needs to be a crime to trigger this dual capacity. And I'll point to State v. Childs, where we enumerate this dual capacity.
Well, my point is that the Ivey probable cause, if there isn't a crime, you're never going to have probable cause, but you surely can be involved in policing duties without having probable cause or having a crime being committed.
Exactly, but you need a policing duty, which is not present in this case. And I guess, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So my question around your argument then, as I'm, interpreting from it, would be, apropos the question that I asked opposing counsel is, at that moment, what could a police officer have done? And your argument, I presume, is he didn't have authority to search the person. The point of looking for it, the omission here was in the context of searching a bag, and that the only authority he had to do that was as a security officer, not as a police officer.
That's correct,
at that point. Later, had some disturbance developed, some police officer duties, you might have kicked into that dual capacity, but at the moment of the alleged negligence, the only action being or conduct being conducted was a security, not policing.
And
And you can tie that then, and one could look at probable cause, like an Ivy or some other, if there's a lower reasonable suspicion in a given circumstance or something. But how does that square with the idea of traffic control and those other types of policing functions that aren't tied to any sort of constitutional standard? And probable cause isn't probably the standard that keeps Judge Rodenberg moving along in the sidewalk when he's going to an Excel game?
I would hope not. It's a good question again. I think, in Graylum, we have a case where there is an officer who is acting at a private job directing traffic, which I think that's kind of the cliche example of a police duty, right? You always see officers directing traffic. The point in Graylum is this guy acting publicly or privately? And what I will say is the court says it's really hard to tell, but they lay that piece of bedrock law for us to work with that says not everything you do, even in a job like that looks kind of like it's public, not everything's going to be considered public. And what I will say is that case says if it's a hard call, if this panel's having a trouble kind of deciding, shoot it to the fact finder. And the fact finder decided in this case and decided that this was not a public duty. And what I will say is on review, this court's job is not to say you disagree. This court's job is to say that the city attorney's decision here is so unreasonable that it is essentially made on a whim. And I just don't think that's true if you look at the actual written decision here. I think
so there can be a public safety policing duty that's separate from the standards for search or seizure or arrest. You're acknowledging that.
I think it's possible, yeah, absolutely, especially under Graylum. What I will say, for example, is in Childs, too, the Childs officer is also hired to work private security at that drugstore. He's hired for the same reason. Now, what happens in Childs, what the Supreme Court says is, okay, well, that security screening, that's private. He tails this guy for 20 minutes inside that drugstore doing an investigation of whether he's shoplifting or not. That's private. It's only for purposes of the arrest that that trigger occurs. So what I'm saying, I guess, is you need to find that duty, that police duty. And I know what I will say, there's a lot of talk, especially in the briefing, about inaction. I'll say I'm the son of two cops, so I've kind of grown up in cop world my whole life. It's hard to think of what public inaction looks like. I'd like to give you an example, if you'll entertain me here, and then kind of tie it into Reitz's case. Let's say that an officer is on duty in a squad car at the side of the road, and a robber comes around the corner, sticks a gun in a pedestrian's face, and says, "Give me your wallet or else." Pedestrian surrenders the wallet, guy grabs it, runs away. Cop, all the while, has the power to do something. And he just says, "Huh, does anybody else see that?" And does nothing. I would argue that's public inaction. Now let's flip that into Reitz's case. Let's say Reitz, on that night, does everything the same. The man comes in, Reitz is, I think, just standing guard. It's not even clear in the record that he's screening. He's standing there kind of looking intimidating when all of a sudden the man pulls out the knife and starts stabbing somebody, and Reitz says, "Is anybody else seeing this?" and does nothing. I think you can make the argument that that's public inaction. Now, inaction, I think, is just a rare thing for cops because everything they do is some kind of affirmative verb, some kind of action verb. But I think you could argue that's public inaction, just like in Carter and, I might pronounce this wrong, Yazwe. Those officers are responding to a breach of law that this court had said is a felony that's being committed in their presence. These cars hurling at pedestrians and these officers are running toward it to stop it. That's not happening here. I also want to touch on the fact of regulation because I think this is a big part of the briefing as well. When it comes to regulation, if you look at Exhibit 17 in that opening paragraph, we tell you why there's this heavy hand of regulation. It's not because we're trying to mix that public-private world. It's the exact opposite. We are saying, we want to know what you're doing in that off time because if we need to recall you, we need you here now. That is why they're wearing uniforms. If we need to make sure you're on duty, we don't want that private life to infect and overwhelm that public life. We need to make sure you're ready to go.
I'm confused about the requirement to wear uniforms. I mean, obviously they're not required to wear uniforms to sleep. So it's not just that you can be ready at a moment. Why is there a requirement to wear uniforms on private pay moonlighting jobs?
So it is because if we need to recall them in an emergency situation, we don't want them going home to change. That private life needs to be able to give way and cede ground to their public life because
But they don't need to, if they're shopping, they don't need to wear their uniform on their off hours.
No, because they have, it's an easier time for them to be able to get to us. We don't require them to wear uniforms 24/7, but we do require them to wear uniforms when they're performing some kind of off-duty work, including, I should mention, not just security. The baseline expectation is if Mr. Reitz wants to sack groceries at Lund's, he is to wear his uniform. We want them to be able to leave that place of employment immediately. And if they're shopping, I think there's a reasonable expectation to say you're allowed to sort of shed that clothing in your private life because it would be simply unreasonable to make you sleep. We're trying to be the least encroachable as possible into that private world as we can while still maintaining supremacy of their public work.
But they don't have to be in a uniform to exercise their police duties.
Absolutely right, which I think cuts to us, right? They don't need to exercise or their public duties in a uniform. That's the Kroll case. So what I'm saying is the fact that he's wearing a uniform is not dispositive in any way, shape, or form.
Does the city really require? I don't know if many officers do. I mean, I was wondering, just this, I thought, what if you're a Macy's, sales clerk and you had the Lund's grocery, et cetera? Do officers really wear uniforms during if they have those non-security jobs?
I would say I don't know the perfect answer to that question. What I will say is I don't believe most officers would like to sack groceries. I did it for a summer. I would complain also about sacking groceries, so I cannot tell you that they do it that often. What I'm saying is it is possible.
Because the policy doesn't seem to, I mean, when reading the policy, it seems to apply to all jobs. And I was wondering whether, it doesn't expressly, I can't envision a reason why someone should be in uniform while they're sacking groceries. It's hard to understand why there's a difference between that and just being at a ball game.
Right. I'm sorry for interrupting you there, Your Honor. It's because of that recall. And I'll also point you to the fact that there is a burn period. There's a time when if you get off that off-duty job, we want to make sure there's enough time built in for your on-duty job because we don't want you to be late. We're trying to paint this line down the center of an officer's public and private life and say, please, for the love of God, don't let them intersect.
Who has the burden of proof on this?
So, Your Honor, the burden of proof is you must uphold the city attorney's position so long as
that's our standard of review. But does the officer have a burden of proof that it was he was acting in a performance of his duties?
That's a good question, Your Honor. You know, I don't know if there's a specific burden of proof that's been articulated in law. I think what's been articulated is you need to identify that dual capacity trigger. You need to be able to find that point in time when the switch flips from sort of purely private to public.
I ask that because you referenced that the record doesn't actually tell us what the officer was doing at the point of entry, standing there or screening or whatever.
No, that is correct, Your Honor. I don't think the record is clear exactly what Mr. Reitz is doing. I think we, to some extent, have assumed he's screening, but that's not necessarily true. He may have just been standing there.
You don't accept the insurance concept of defense and indemnity that where it's arguably within the policy or arguably in performance of duties.
I don't, Your Honor, just because using statutory interpretation analysis, if the language is clear from its face, you go with the language. And the language of the statute says the city shall defend and indemnify as long as that officer is, quote, acting in the performance of the duties of the position, end quote. The language in the statute says nothing about bifurcating it between defense and indemnification. I realize that's true in insurance, but I'm just working with what I have for the statute using principles of statutory interpretation. And I don't believe that's ambiguous in any way, shape, or form. Your Honors, I don't have much else for you. If there are no other questions, I would just respectfully ask that you affirm the denial of defense and indemnification in this case. I do want to thank my co-counsels for their great job in briefing, and I want to thank the court for its time as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Renz, do you wish to use your rebuttal time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to make a couple of points in relation to what opposing counsel had to say. First of all, I know we've had some discourse about what it is that he was actually doing, Officer Reitz, at the time. 2 points about that. Number one, I don't know that matters what he actually was doing. The question is what he was accused of doing.
We got to look at the complaint.
Yeah, and the admitted complaint is that he was accused of failing to search and locate a knife in the course of his duties. The amended
complaint. This isn't a Rule 12 question. I mean, this is a question of fact where a quasi-judicial decision where based on investigation and facts, a decision maker decides that he was not acting in performance of his duties. I don't know that a complaint just alleging that someone is acting in performance of their duties actually is evidence that the person was when there's factual findings in the decision, in a quasi-judicial decision that we're reviewing.
I can appreciate that there may be other things taken into account, but if the question is whether or not they're going to defend an officer for that which he is accused of doing, the question is what he was accused of doing and where he was and what the circumstances were at the time. So I think they both play in, but I don't think we can ignore what the amended complaint is really about, which is whether or not he was keeping the public safety in the way that they wanted him to, which was to search those bags. The second point I would make about that is also pointing to the amended complaint, paragraph 17. This is on page 4 of our reply brief. This Officer Reitz was not in some ambiguous security role. And I feel like both in briefing and in argument, there's this temptation by the opposing party to paint this and conflate these into a security agent. He's not a security agent. If he was a security agent, he wouldn't have all the emblems of the city authority. If he was a security agent, he wouldn't be hired as they do between the sheriff's department, the police department, and Dorothy Day, these arrangements to have an officer there only for 2 hours a night. If it was a security agent, you just keep the people you're invariably paying less to do that doing that. Instead, they need the badge. Sorry.
You referenced right now, and I think in your brief, and I was wondering about this, you talk about agreements between Dorothy Day and the city. The only agreement that I see in a record is between the officer and Dorothy Day. What evidence, what are you referring to, and what evidence is there in a record related to agreements between the city and Dorothy Day?
I'm referring to the amended complaint at paragraph 17 describing the Dorothy Day arrangements with the St. Paul Police Department and the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department.
And did you put in any, is there any written agreement? Did you put in any factual evidence of that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Don't you need to? Don't you need to actually do more than amend a complaint, and if you want defense indemnification, to actually put in the evidence on which a decision maker can make a decision?
No, for two reasons. One, I think that the amended complaint, which is the basis on which we are seeking indemnification, set it out. So going back to the kind of the point I was just trying to make a moment ago. Secondly, I don't even know that it matters whether there's an arrangement or not. They knew he was going to be there. The whole
You cited the agreement a couple times in your brief and just now, so I assumed you thought it mattered. That's why I'm asking about it.
Well, I think it is an even further indication. Like I was saying before, I think there are many pieces of this that add up to the fact that there is no doubt that the city in this case should have indemnified Officer Reitz. That's one of them. All I'm saying is even if you took that out, I think it doesn't change where he is on the continuum of indemnification and defense. One of the reasons that I think that's important is this is all in the city's control. Not only is it in the purview of their knowledge, they've got the scheduler, they give permission to use all these things. They could not do it if they want. They could say, you can't work off duty. They could say, you can work off duty, but don't do it in uniform. You can do it in uniform, but don't take the squad officers. They don't. They not only allow it all, they strictly regulate it. I point to Exhibit 17. Which includes the manual, off-duty officers are even subject to inspection. The city is maintaining constant control over their officers, and they're permitting this to happen. And it's only when something goes bad that they cut these people loose. And that is not the way that the defense indemnification statute should be applied. It's bad public policy, and it requires officers to not know when there's going to be coverage or not. According to opposing counsel's argument, sometimes you are. If you leap into action, you might be. But then if it doesn't seem like there's somebody shoplifting, you aren't. That is no way to move forward. And so in order to have an even, clear base, I'm sorry, my time is up.
No, you can finish your thought.
In order to have an even, clear, and enforceable basis, it should be uniformly and cleanly approached, which is when you have all these emblems of city authority and you're acting in a way that includes performance of duties, which go way beyond arrest, there should be indemnification. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. We appreciate the briefing and argument from both of counsel. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. Thank you.